Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Daniela Gutierrez Flores, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Mabel Moraña about her new book entitled Philosophy and Criticism in Latin America, published by Cambria Press. Professor Mabel Moraña, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Daniela.
I wonder if you could begin this interview by telling our audience a little bit about yourself, what your scholarly education has been, and how this book fits into your current moment as a scholar.
Very good. As many people know, I'm from Uruguay and started my studies in my country, both in literature and philosophy. At the time, I was always debating if I should devote myself to literature or remain in the field of philosophy. And later on, I discovered that that was not anything that I should be worried about, that I could work articulating both fields. And thus, this book is a perfect example of that, that although I continued in the field of literary criticism and later on cultural theory, I was always attentive to philosophical developments and always trying to think about literature, aesthetics, and elements of representation in connection to philosophical topics. So this book is, in a way, a good introduction to that articulation between letters and fiction and philosophy. That's why the book starts with a presentation of the different sides, or the comparison, or the consideration vis-a-vis between philosophy and criticism, to which extent these two fields of inquiry connect, to which extent they are really differentiated, how much of criticism is in philosophy, and how much of philosophical thinking or philosophical speculation we can find in a literary or cultural criticism. So I think that that is an interesting introduction in the sense that it summarizes a lot of questions that I myself had while I was working in either one of those fields, discovering how much of philosophical thinking there is in the attempt to interpret literary text, either poetry, of course, in the composition of essays, in fiction, in the preparation of fictional scenarios, characters, situations, etc. So this book, in a way, that is one of the direction or one of the axes of the book. But the book is divided itself, that is the introduction, but the book is divided itself in two parts. In the first one, I consider authors from Latin America that have undertaken philosophical thinking, that have philosophical writings, essays, reflections, books in which they explore different ways to think about Latin America and to think about political and social issues from a Latin American perspective. But of course, that is not completely separated from European or global thinking, if you want to put it that way. You know, although we can think about the specificity of Latin American a philosophical reflection or Latin American thought, or as others authors say, Latin American history of ideas, we still have a lot of connections to explore between those reflections and European philosophy. Anglo-Saxon, Mediterranean, many cultures, many societies in Europe or in the Western hemisphere have thought about colonialism, about the nation, about society, about power, many of the topics that are the essence of Latin American philosophical thinking. And in the second part of the book, then I approach several European authors such as Michel Foucault, Walter Benjamin, let me see what else, Peter Sloterdijk, trying to see how they connect to Latin American problems and how much Latin American thinking fits or does not fit into their philosophical paradigms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciated, really liked how the first part is devoted to the Latin American authors like José Carlos Mariátegui and Enrique Dussel, Echeverría, Roger Bartra. And then the second part, it's where all of these names that are so familiar to anyone in North American academia. I really like the fact that you start discussing the names of Latin American thought first. And so at the beginning of the book, you state, and I quote here, that the objective of this book is not to recognize once again the sources of pre-Hispanic, Amerindian, or Afro-Hispanic thought in different regions and historical moments, nor does this book attempt to return to the debates around the existence of a properly Latin American philosophy. Rather, this book offers timely contributions to the process of conceptualizing a Latin American specificity and its forms of integration in larger contexts. So could you talk more about how this specific project, you already mentioned a little bit about this, but how this specific book project was conceived and how it fits into your philosophical and critical preoccupations more widely?
Yes, that clarification in the introduction of the book has to do with the fact that, you know, a good part of Latin American philosophical or critical development had been focused obsessively on the idea, on the debate about the possibility of existence of proper Latin American thinking. The idea was that being Latin American society is the byproduct of colonialism. Is it possible in those societies, in those cultures, to develop a really original philosophical body of ideas or works? Or is post-colonial thinking always going to be tied and limited and restricted or conditioned by the thinking that is being developed in what used to be, metropolitan societies or metropolitan cultures, either in Europe, in the Anglo-Saxon world, etc.? In other words, is it possible to develop a really independent, original, emancipated thinking in post-colonial societies, or are they too much conditioned by the prestige and the depth of the European tradition? So I didn't want to get into that debate, because really at this point I consider it a little outdated. That have been responded, that debate has been clarified from many perspectives, and the actual development of ideas and critical thinking in Latin America shows that what we could call the post-colonial condition is providing thinkers and critics in Latin America of a different perspective, a perspective that is impossible to cultivate in the same manner in what used to be imperial cultures or societies. Because this thinking in Latin America is showing the position of and the location, the ideological location of those that were, dominated and subsumed into the strength of metropolitan cultures. So I really think that there are many, many examples, and what I do in this book is just an introduction to that, to the originality and the rareness in many ways of Latin American thinking that is informed by a different kind of social consciousness than the one that you can find in central, to call it that way, in cultures or in places of thinking. So that was basically the idea, just not to discuss in abstract if Latin American thinking could or could not be emancipated and original or was condemned to the mere reproduction of European ideas, but to show through the study of original thinkers how far Latin American thinking has gone in the theorization of Latin America's place at a planetary level, and about, you know, the discussion of many other topics that were considered a part of universal cultures. So that was basically the idea. And to respond to your second question, that say, what is the place that this book occupies in my own intellectual development, I have to say that, you know, since I work always in a parallel way in literary studies, in questions of the connections between aesthetics and politics, between ethics and aesthetics and things like that, I'm used to thinking about literature and representation from a philosophical perspective. And every time I, read European authors, I My instinct is to search for those concepts or elaborations that tend to help Latin American thinking to develop ideas around issues of political domination, cultural marginality, and things like that. So the book really emerged very naturally because I had already studied, for instance, the contributions of Michel Foucault, who was a very, very influential thinker in Latin America, very influential at all levels. Also, I have a book that is devoted to Pierre Bourdieu, Bourdieu en la Periferia in Spanish, Bourdieu at the Periphery. So I also wanted to show in the case of Pierre Bourdieu the great contribution that Bourdieu made to Latin American thinking, particularly at the methodological level. But also I incorporated a different aspect, critical aspect, indicating how much Bourdieu would have really benefited if he had known better about Latin American specificity. Because many of the things and the concepts that he develops for the European context would have been enriched by the Latin American experience. And many of his considerations at many times, on many occasions, in places where he had been very influential, like Brazil, Mexico, etc., they have been criticism. There have been a serious critique of his thinking because some of his models do not fit really in a reality like the Latin American one. And those are realities that, of course, being French, although enriched also by his own experience of colonialism between Europe and Argelia and things like that, Bourdieu had a notion about all of those elements, but he didn't know enough about Latin America. So although he was very interested, he was in Argentina debating, and you know, and that was a very enriching experience for him. But still, in his methodological apparatus, many elements that the Latin American experience would have helped clarify are missing. So, you know, what I'm trying to show is that really what is needed is a dialogue and, you know, a dialogue between equals, between Latin American thinkers and European philosophy. And that is one of the objectives of the book.
Yeah, in that sense, I think it's very important, not only for the field of Latin American studies, but in general for, as you say, to anyone who's interested in actually building a dialogue and an intellectual exchange between different fields. So you begin the book, the first chapter is a discussion of an important figure for Latin America and Latin American studies, of course, and that is the Peruvian thinker José Carlos Mariátegui. And specifically, you discuss his reflection on the concepts of emancipation and colonialism. For our audience here, what would you say are Mariátegui's contributions to these issues, to these questions, and more widely to Marxist thought?
Well, you know, Mariátegui is one of the most influential and original thinkers, not only for Latin America, but also for Marxism at large, as you know, as a general political theory, because he was able, Mariátegui was able to, in a way, to rethink or to attempt to see different dimensions in this, after all, 19th century European theory that is Marxism. He was trying to bring Marxism to Latin America and again to see how really that theory and that praxis behind Marxism could fit Latin American needs. For Mariátegui, the Peruvian reality is the primary source of his concerns. The application of Marxism is always subject to the efficiency that Marxism could have for the elaboration of an emancipated thought in Latin America that could be useful for the integration of so many social sectors that have been marginalized for what we call the Creole Republic, right? He was confronting the Peruvian situation at times of populism, in times of Leguía, at the time the president of Peru, and trying to think the place of the indigenous majority of people in Peruvian society. What was the role of that huge sector of Peruvian population that was now at the time, and we are talking about the 1930s, being integrated into the models of modernization. So he was trying to see, you know, the importance that at moments of industrialization, this huge contingency of workers, of indigenous workers, the role that they could have in the construction of Andean modernity. And he understood that if those workers were going to have either as campesinos or as peasants or as workers in the industrial world, if they were going to have an economic role, they were always going, also going to be a very important political force. So Mariátegui was trying to see, you know, how that is a Marxist theory based on the existence of a wide and powerful proletariat. It was going to adapt to the reality of Peru, where peasants were basically the social subject, if you want to put it that way. So it's a very important tour de force for Marxism to be applied to a reality where race plays such an important role. As you know, is not the main concern of Marxism. Marxism is basically thinking around the notion of class. But in the case of Peru, the notion of race is really a substantial, or we could even say a primary element. So that is a very important correction between quotation marks to Marxism that we are witnessing here, because it is showing that obviously Marx couldn't think about any possible social and political reality. He was thinking about Europe at the time when he was producing his works and having the debates that surrounded the emergence of Marxism. But for Mariátegui in the 1930s, in a completely different reality that had not even been considered by Marx, except in very general terms around the topics of colonialism and things like that, but facing the specificities of the Andean society, of the unfair and terribly fragmented Andean society, Mariátegui was trying to explore how far Marxism could go or could adapt to the challenges of post-colonial societies. So that is a huge leap in Latin American thought. If you think about it, there were no other time in history, not before Mariátegui, no after Mariátegui, where Latin America had really had an alternative to liberal thought. This is the first time, the unique time when Latin Americans thinking about their own, the position of Latin America in the world, in history, etc., in the process of liberation, have the possibility to confront liberal thinking with Marxist alternatives. That is a very, very important moment in the development of ideas. As you can see, nowadays we usually hear this notion that it's impossible to think outside of liberalism because we are also immersed into it, right? That there is not like a different position to look at the whole picture. We are always looking to liberalism from inside. In the times of Mariátegui, he opens up that other platform for people to think about the political reality and to interpret it, thinking about a different possible development.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I think in that sense, Mariátegui is such a clear example of what you call across your book of the blind spot, right? The ways in which Eurocentric thought missed or ignored certain aspects that stood outside the limits of the European realities or historical realities over the time, and how these Latin American thinkers, like Mariátegui in this case, addressed these blind spots to really think about these issues in their own terms, in the terms of the specific reality of Latin American countries, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And well, mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, it's just, it's still a challenge, right? Mariátegui was doing this in the first half of the 20th century. But this is something that that still happens in the field, right? It's a challenge to be able to really pay attention to the cultural and historical specificities of a region, especially being as... in the site of initiation of North American academia, for example.
Absolutely. I think that, for instance, Mariátegui, almost a century ago, was calling everybody's attention about race, something that today is, you know, on the table for everybody. You know, now it's everybody's agenda. But he saw that that was the key, you know, concept to unlock the problematic situation of Latin America after colonialism was gone. But he talks about what was translated in my book as vestigial colonialism, that mm-hmm. was in Spanish, colonialismo superstite, mm-hmm. meaning that part of colonialism that Aníbal Quijano would call later coloniality, meaning those elements of colonialism that perpetuate themselves into modernity, right? So that's where the difference between independence and emancipation becomes important. Because one thing is to declare independence and see that, you know, Portugal and Spain are left behind as metropolitan powers, and now we are independent nation states and this and that. But the true emancipation, not only of societies, but also of intellectual categories, through which Latin Americans can think about themselves, that is a process that is still going on. That's why we see today the discourses about or the topics of decolonization, because that's still a work that has to be done, that has to be completed, that has to be developed. So Mariátegui has immense importance in Latin American thinking. No students of Latin American studies should ignore or obtain any kind of degree without knowing exactly what Mariátegui did for Latin America and for Western thinking in general. It's a very, very, very important source or tradition that then was developed by Cornejo Polar in the field of literary studies, was developed at the sociological level by Aníbal Quijano and many others, and also in critical theory by a Bolivian critic, Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui, and so many others, and by so many also in the United States that follow those steps. So that is a real, really original and innovative tradition that has no roots in European thinking, right? Because, you know, Europe, who utilized race as a way to legitimize the appropriation of human and natural resources in the colonies, did not theorize about race or ethnicity. They just took that as a given, right, that supposedly justified the domination of others in the benefit of European elites. But looking at that from the perspective of the Latin American subject or subjectivity, the situation is different, right? That's why Latin American thought theorized race and ethnicity and is still doing it. But Mariátegui's foundational thinking is very, very important in this process.
Yeah, and also Mariátegui's thought is so connected to other colonial thinkers, no? Like Inca Garcilaso de la Vega that you bring up.
Absolutely.
That his very original thinking has roots in the continent, although one could argue if Inca Garcilaso was or not Peruvian, that's out of the question here, right?
He was absolutely Peruvian.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
But he had, as the social subject had at the time, bicultural nature, you know, but he identified, you know, a lot of his thinking identified with the maternal side. And while he was trained in European thinking, that's why his ideas are so incredibly challenging, because they managed to articulate and even to integrate the conflict between both sides of the coin, right? It's a very, very important element that Mariátegui knew very, very well. But, you know, in this book, I decided to go from modern times to the present, because I was not going, you know, to Guamampoma de Ayala. You know, that is another book. And much of that book has been written by people who know a lot about Andean colonial literature. But this book is, is a problematization of modernity, basically.
Yeah. And I was interested in your chapter about Bolívar Echeverría titled 1492, you mentioned that his work has not received the attention that it deserves.
You're talking about Dussel?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, sorry, Dussel. And that you considered his work fundamental for the field and in general for the advancement of some of these questions in the field of Latin American studies. Could you share some of the ideas that you consider so central and indispensable of his thought?
Yes, I I don't know what is we needed to happen for people to really pay Enrique Dussel the attention that he deserves. He's a thinker of a transnational stature, really. He had been recognized by many European philosophers. He had debated with many of them. He now has been has a very solid place in Mexican thought because he has developed most of his intellectual career in Mexico, though he's from Argentina originally. But still, his ideas and his thinking and the dimension and the projection of his ideas are not really recognized yet, in my opinion. I don't know what it's going to take. In some cases, after the author is not with us anymore, then a huge reconsideration of his or her works takes place, and maybe we are going to witness that. But for now, still, Enrique Dussel is his ideas circulate in an important area or intellectual space, but not enough, in my opinion. He's really an incredibly productive. He has, I don't know how many works, huge volumes of ethics and aesthetics and social studies and studies of religion and this and that. But the originality of his ideas, the way in which he proposes to reread Western history, paying attention to the fact that, for instance, the centrality of Europe really occurred when Spain discovered, between quotation marks, the New World. Before that, way before that, Arab or Muslim nations or Muslim cultures and Oriental cultures were the center of the universe, the center of the world, right? Those cultures were the ones that were considered the nucleus of civilization in the world. But with the discovery of the New World, Europe repositions itself in a different way, right? And with that, a different cultural redefinition starts to take place. And in the book that is called 1492, Enrique Dussel explains how the so-called discovery of America really, that America needs to be rediscovered, right? Because in many ways, the so-called discovery of America, discovery only for those who just arrived, because many, many cultures were living here, that had already discovered their own territories, right? but he says, in many ways that it conceals America because it's included in elaborations that really don't let the place of that of those cultures shine. It don't let those original cultures be visible to the Europeans, because they're only being interpreted and represented through European lenses, right? Through the lenses of the dominators, who see in the New World an opportunity for enrichment, for the exploitation of new territories, for commerce, for expansion, etc., etc. So it's very important how he shows that when we talk about Eurocentrism, sometimes we miss the main aspect of the issue because we are not seeing that centrality of Europe, that, by the way, is a matter of the past, because in so many ways, Europe is not at the center of anything right now, right? Mm-hmm. The focus, the central focus of globalization is not Europe, right, at the moment. But Dussel is thinking about modern times and how really most of our misconceptions about the supposedly marginal place of Latin America or in the borders of the global systems, it has to do with our ideological, in the Marxist sense of false consciousness, ideological understanding of the centrality of Europe. 1482 is an indispensable book. It's a book that everybody should read and reread and rethink and discuss with others and criticize, if you wish. But it's a source for a lot of reflection about critical thinking, about political developments, about the place of Latin America in global times, etc., etc. So in that sense, Enrique Dussel's contributions are enormous. Not to mention that he was also at the center of the philosophy of liberation, a very, very important movement of emancipation that has a lot to do with the agendas of decolonization of the global South, for instance. It's impossible to understand decolonization without understanding the role that played at the time the philosophy of liberation, of which Dussel is not the only member, but there is a movement that was transnationalized and that took into consideration the possible articulation of politics and religion. A very, very important source of ideas and projects and critiques of modernity and capitalism, etc., etc.
Yeah, as I was reading this first section of the book, but really across all of it, one issue that kept coming up repeatedly, beginning with Mariátegui, but it's also obviously present in Dussel, in Bourdieu, and in the chapter on humanism, is that of the political ethos of the Latin American intellectual. That is a central question for many of the figures that you discuss. So what would you say, how have these thinkers conceived their role in Latin American society as intellectuals and philosophers?
Well, Daniela, you have read the book attentively, because really that is one of the main directions that I follow there, the definition of Latin American intellectualism, or the role of Latin American intellectuals always deeply involved in political issues. That is in a characteristic that you can find in many post-colonial societies. That's why the philosophers or the critics from India are also so, in many, many cases, very politically engaged, or from Argelia or from many other places. It's that idea that it's impossible to think about life, about the development of ideas about society, about the about being, about death, etc., without understanding the political implications of ideas. So Latin American intellectuals have always been involved in political thinking. In many cases, intellectuals, especially in the 19th century, who were presidents or who had important political roles, like Sarmiento or many others, who had a very humanistic formation, or background. The consideration of literature, philosophy, history, and all of those fields as part of political understanding of reality was common to all intellectuals from the beginning. And, you know, there is a direct line that connects Creole letrados, ¿verdad? The letrados criollos of colonial times to what they become the intellectuals of independent nations, right? We don't call them letrados anymore, like Alfonso Reyes or Andrés Bello. Those are the intellectuals, national intellectuals, right? Because they are tied, they are connected to the nation state as a political and administrative formation. That is a very important element to understand the role of intellectual, the definition of intellectual mission, right? That is not to cultivate an alternative world, right? Torre de Marfil or something, some place to escape from reality. But the role of intellectuals was to get immersed into the conflicts of society and to be a critical voice, right? Latin American intellectuals never understood the role as organic intellectuals in the sense of participating or having a cooperative role with respect to political power. The intellectual has to be outside those circles in order to be able to criticize. And with this, I don't mean destructive criticism, but develop a critique of the system, right? And always his heart had to be with those that were marginalized from the system. He always had to be for integration, for inclusion, right? It would be very interesting to explore how much of that mission or that definition of intellectual roles is changing today, right? And now that many intellectuals are turning into political or cultural advisors or technocrats. See what I mean? Right there, they become so specialized, and Lyotard works on that in his book on the postmodern, it becomes so immersed into the intricacies of technological thinking that in many cases they leave out their commitment, their political commitment and their political definition. A technocrat works for the powers that are already established, right? And to the development of, more sophisticated political apparatus or is on the side of power, right? A political intellectual should have been conceived, and the case of Mariátegui is a very good example, as somebody who needs to keep his distance or her distance from power in order not to be contaminated. And by that, Mariátegui also included the notion of the university, right? He said, I keep myself as far as possible from university thinking, right? Because in a way, he understood that the university domesticates thinking, right? It channels people or ideas in courses that have already been prescribed or that can be controlled, while Mariátegui's thinking is much more revolutionary in the constructive sense of the word, right? In the sense that, social and political change and economic change come from critique of the establishment, not from a complicity with it. Right? And, you know, that distance was a key to Mariátegui and, to many other intellectuals that followed.
And that is somewhat an issue that you touch upon in, by the end of the book, which is the place of humanism in the context of a university market, an educational market that is really governed by neoliberal logics, right? What is the place of the intellectual now in this context?
Your question is, what is the place of the intellectual in this context?
Yeah, just if you could talk a little bit about this question that you discuss in this chapter about humanism.
Yeah, well, you know, humanism and by extension the humanities in general terms have been under attack for a long, long time, right? And now that everything is controlled by the market, obviously it's not in the humanities where people are going to make money, right? Because the humanities, as we were saying, tend to criticize or tend to see the conflicts between this and that and the need for change and identify with different subjects at a social political level, etc. So there is a conflict between the humanities and the current society ruled by the market, right? That is an obvious conflict that we see having a direct impact on the university today at every level. Very, very clearly in the United States. In Latin America, the dynamics are different, and it should take a long time to understand that other dynamics. But in the case of the United States, where the market is so prominent, we can see how the humanities really are considered like fields that have nothing to offer, right? All of that, you know, is something that people do in order to cultivate their minds, you know, in a specific manner, but are not really something that will be pragmatically useful for society as a whole, right? The current state of affairs does not need people thinking. They need people consuming, right? They need people following, right? They need people who want to be a part of the system of consumption and production and constant productivity, right? We all of us have, in a way, are in a way part of that wheel, right, of a constant productivity, right? Humanism has a different logic, right? And in many ways, I'm not saying that for that reason humanism cannot be articulated to the current model of society, but I'm saying that we as humanists have been so far inefficient in that kind of critical or in that kind of selective integration. You know, we are still part of, in my opinion, educational systems that do not completely understand, we don't even completely understand the role of what we have to offer in the current world, right? Many of us at some point start, you know, make a stop in whatever we are doing or thinking to reflect on how useful or unuseful it really is in view of the things that are happening in the world, what we do, right? Yeah. How I'm really, really contributing, you know, to the tragedies of migration, to the problems presented for public health, to the horrors of this terrible prominence of the thought and the practice of the right, right? So in many ways, all of us have that problem of guilty consciousness, right? With respect of what we do, right? And that is because we have been unable to rethink because this is not the first time that the humanities face a challenge like that, right? To feel that that what they have to offer is legitimate and useful and fundamental for the understanding of the world. So we are still struggling with our consciousness and with the, in many ways, obsolete models of thinking that we are not effectively placing as a tradition. We are still, in many cases, trying to revive things that really do not adapt to the current situation, but that is for lack of alternatives. We need another Mariátegui showing us how to think about this from outside, right? How to find another alternative. And in my opinion, also the fall of the left has been a tragedy, right? In the sense that before Latin American thinking was guided by that utopia of a different possible world. And, you know, we have been still, we're still struggling with the elaboration of failure. That is a process that some people might think that is going very, very slowly, but, you know, it's going to take the time that it's going to take. That is tragic because that left us with no clear alternatives to the state of affairs that we are witnessing in the world today. Something that has that is affecting the environment, that is affecting the position of women, the situation of young people, the of new generations, the state of education, etc., etc. So the humanities are, in my opinion, a little behind in the debate. That is something that we should recognize and do, you know, whatever we can to stimulate, to revive, to create spaces for dialogue, for debate even. I don't know if you have the same idea that people do not debate anymore. People go to conferences or, you know, online or in presence, and people love to agree. You know, let's, you know, agree to disagree. And in that sense, you know, people say different things that you can see that are really controversial, but people say nothing and then they go to their own, you know, they returned to their own place and nothing happened. It wasn't like that, right? And we, I think that we need to recover the passion of debate in order to, you know, to communicate to the new generation that not everything is lost and that, you know, we have to be brave enough to assign responsibility. What is happening to the environment? What is happening to the to the system of public health? What is happening, right? And who is responsible for it? Not agree to disagree anymore. That would be my recommendation.
Well, I think in that sense, this book is so stimulating because it is about polemics and disagreements between different lines of thought and thinkers. So, yeah, I think in that sense, it's such a stimulating read for anyone who wants to recover that ethos of debate.
Yes, Danielle, I think that you are right on that.
And, well, I've taken enough of your time now. I wanted to wrap up by just noting that this book was originally published in Spanish, right?
Yes, yeah. By Metales Pesados, an independent press in Santiago de Chile, and now in translation by Cambria Press.
So if anyone out there is listening and just know that it is... You can read it in both languages. I did want to ask you what this translation to English means to this particular book for you in this current moment that we're in?
Oh, very, very important for me. Andrew Ashton and I work closely in the translation of this book, also in the translation of my book, The Monster as a War Machine, that in many, many ways is thematically very linked to this one, although the corpus that I explore in that book is completely different. For me, to this translation allow me to circulate with different audiences and different kind of students and colleagues, and that has been an interesting thing. Yes,
very absolutely valuable in precisely building those networks that are so needed. Right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Moraña, for your time. This was such a stimulating conversation.
Thank you, Danielle. It's been a pleasure for me, really.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.